Okay, we're back for episode 91, if I got that right. Powers of Principalities, episode 91. Joe, how you doing?
Tim, that's kind of, as I was talking before that we started the show, that's really quite a serious question right now, because I'm just filled with endorphins. And I just can't stop smiling and feeling great. I don't know why. I mean, it's just so unlike me. And it's directly related. You know, I was gone for 3 weeks. I was in New Zealand doing hiking, and we hiked all of these trails. They're very, you know, pretty hard for kind of non-tracking people like myself. They were tough. And some days you'd be out there for 9 hours, you know, maybe like 15 miles. A short day would be like 8 or 9 miles, but it's never as the crow flies, you know, because you're always kind of. So it was a lot. It was all this walking. And when I was there, I was like gimped up, you know, and I was taking a leave. I normally never take any chemicals, but I was so gimped up, I was actually taking anti-inflammatories. Mm-hmm. And I was on the ice pack, and I was, you know, swearing I'd never, like, leave my chair in my den again. You know?
Your comfortable chair.
Yeah. And then I got back, and all of a sudden I just, well, first of all, a bizarre, like, physiological miracle occurred, and I dropped like 10 pounds. I hadn't lost any weight at all in New Zealand. Not particularly overweight, but, you know, kind of typical American. Well, yeah. You know, I try to work out. I'm not fat, but suddenly I dropped 10 pounds out of just nowhere. And then all this, like, endorphin stuff happened. I just felt really terrific about everything. And so I'm trying to figure out the relationship. And I think that maybe if you really stress the body with these long distance walks, you kind of activate maybe the immune system. I don't know. I'm just going to grasp at straws and say the two things were related. But in any case, I've had this like second teenager phenomenon, you know, occur. I'll tell you, there's nothing more dangerous than someone my age that feels this good. You really you should, like, just call the police, you know, before the evening begins, because, you know, I'm going to get in trouble. But anyway, so I'm feeling good. How about you? How's everything out there in on the East Coast?
Oh, good. Well, it's we're getting closer to spring. So although it hasn't warmed up yet, that's okay. I actually like the change of seasons. And I like winter for the most part.
Sure.
But yeah, you're right. As far as that kind of trail exercise, kind of walking rough terrain, assuming, you know, you don't have an ankle injury or some, you know, something like that. It's, they say, especially as you get older, it's the best exercise.
It's just astonishing. And I'm going to actually try in this next week to do a lot of long distance to see if I can actually maintain this kind of positive outlook about existence, you know, just feeling really good.
But you're getting in the sun, and you probably got a lot of vitamin D in these things.
That's right, yeah. You know, and so, and also, you know, I think computers are kind of bad. I spend a lot of time on computers. And out there, we were, you know, if you're a tracker, you know, you would know about trails, like the kind of trails you're walking, like the Root Burn or the Milford Track or the Greenstone, the Kepler. We were doing all of these, like, New Zealand trails that they have set up, you know, and you'd go from lodge to lodge or from hut to hut, you know. And so, you know, it's pretty structured, you know what I mean? It was like you just get up in the day and you'd head out toward the next destination. And so I'm thinking of trying to mimic that to see if, in fact, I can, you know, maintain this, this kind of like strange feeling of physiological pleasure of existence, you know. I've been like, it's been like 50 years, I think, since I experienced anything like that. So anyway, someone who isn't feeling particularly good is good old Lyndon LaRouche Jr. We agreed to talk about him, and he died recently. He died, what was it?
About a couple weeks ago, February 12th.
He died when I was in New Zealand. So what do you make of LaRouche? He's got to be one of the most interesting kind of, you know, for a lot of reasons, characters in America in the last, 50, 60 years.
Yeah, he was a interesting character, to say the, you know, say the least. Lyndon LaRouche, born September 8th, 1922, passed away September 12th, 2019. He was an American political activist and founder of LaRouche Movement. This is I drew this from Wikipedia. The Lurish Movement's main organization was the National Caucus for Labor Committees, NCLC. He wrote on economic, scientific, and political topics, as well as on history, philosophy, and psychoanalysis. Lurish was a presidential candidate in each election from 1976 to 2004. I think that's a record. Running once for his own U.S. Labor Party and even and seven times for the Democratic Party nomination. Despite Lurish's self-identification with the left, some leftist policies, his critics have said that he had fascistic tendencies, took positions on the far right, and created disinformation. He was born in Rochester, New Hampshire, the oldest of three children of Jesse, Leonore, and Lyndon H. LaRouche, Sr. His paternal grandfather's family emigrated to the United States from Rimouski, Quebec, whereas his maternal grandmother was born in Scotland. His parents became Quakers after his father converted from Catholicism. They forbade him from fighting with other children, even in self-defense, which he said led to years of hell from bullies at school. As a result, he spent much of his time taking long walks through the woods, identifying in his mind with great philosophers. As a Quaker, he was a conscientious objector during World War II and joined the Civilian Public Services Camp. In 1944, he joined the United States Army as a non-combatant and served in India and Burma with medical units. He ultimately worked as an ordnance clerk at the end of the war. He described his decision to serve as one of the most important of his life. While in India, he developed a sympathy for the Indian independence movement. He discussed Marxism in the conscientious objector camp, and while traveling home on the SS General Bradley in 1946, he met one Don Merrill, a fellow soldier, also from Lynn, who converted him to Trotskyism. In 1948, the next year, he joined the Socialist Workers' Party, adopting the name Lynn Marcus for his political work. By 1961, Lurish was married and living in Central Park West in Manhattan, and Lurish's activities were mostly focused on his career and not on the Socialist Workers' Party. He and his wife separated in 1963, and he moved into the Greenwich Village apartment with another Socialist Workers' Party member, Carol Schnitzer, also known as Larrabee. Interesting, he was a character on Get Smart. I don't know if that's... In 1964, he began an association with the Socialist Workers' Party faction called the Revolutionary Tendency, a faction which was later expelled from the Socialist Workers' Party. It came under the influence of British Trotskyist leader Jerry Healey. In 1967, Lurish began teaching classes on Marx's dialectical materialism at New York City's Free School and attracted a group of students from Columbia University and City College of New York, recommending that they read Das Kapital as well as Hegel, Kant, and Leibniz. During the 1968 Columbia University protest, he organized his supporters under the name National Caucus for Labor Committee. The aim of the NCLC was to win control of the Students for Democratic Society branch, the university's main activist group. In the 1970s, he established a private intelligence network. Robert J. Alexander writes that Lurish first established the NCLC intelligence network in 1971. Members all over the world would send information to the NCLC headquarters, which would distribute the information via briefings and other publications. Lurish organized the network as a series of news services and magazines, which critics say was done to gain access to government officials under press cover. The publications included the Executive Intelligence Review, founded in 1974. Other periodicals under his aegis included New Solidarity, Fusion Magazine, 21st Century Science and Technology, and the Campaigner Magazine. U.S. sources told the Washington Post in 1985 that LaRouche's organization had assembled a worldwide network of government and military contacts, and that his researchers sometimes supplied information to government officials. Bobby Ray Inman, the CIA's deputy director in 1981 and 1982, said LaRouche and his wife had visited him, offering information about the West German Green Party. A CIA spokesman said LaRouche met Deputy Director John McCann in 1983 to discuss one of Lurish's trips overseas. An aide to Deputy Secretary of State William Clark said one of Lurish's associates discussed technology or economics. They made good sense and seemed to be qualified. Norman Bailey, formerly with the National Security Council, said in 1984 that LaRouche's staff comprised one of the best private intelligence services in the world. They do know a lot of people around the world. They get to talk to prime ministers and presidents. From the 1970s through the first decade of the 21st century, LaRouche founded several groups and companies. In addition to the National Caucus for Labor Committee, there is the Citizens Electoral Council that was in Australia, the National Democratic Policy Committee, the Fusion Energy Foundation, and the U.S. Labor Party. In 1984, he founded the Schiller Institute in Germany, which, with his second wife and three political parties. And he also founded three political parties there. LaRouche wrote in his 1987 autobiography that violent altercations had begun in 1969 between the NCLC members and several New Left groups when Mark Rudd's faction began assaulting LaRouche's faction at Columbia University. Press accounts allege that between April and September 1973, during what LaRouche called the Operation Mop-Up, NCLC members began physically attacking members of leftist groups that LaRouche called leftist proto-fascists. In an editorial, LaRouche's New Solidarity said of the Communist Party that the movement must dispose of these stinking corpse. Armed with chains, bats, and martial arts nunchuck sticks, NCLC members assaulted Communist Party, Socialist Workers Party, and Progressive Labor Party members and Black Power activists on the streets and during the meeting. So it was very much thinking of that 60s scene, I guess. At least 60 assaults were reported. LaRouche critics such as Denise King and Anthony Lehrman alleged that in 1973, and with little warning, LaRouche adopted more extreme ideas, a process accompanied by a campaign of violence against his opponents on the left, and the development of conspiracy theories and paranoia about his personal safety. According to these accounts, he began to believe that he was under the threat of assassination from the Soviet Union, the CIA, Libya, drug dealers, bankers. He also established a biological Holocaust task force, which, according to LaRouche, analyzed the public health consequences of International Monetary Fund austerity policies toward impoverished nations of Africa, and predicted that epidemics of cholera, as well as possibly entirely new diseases, would strike Africa in the 1980s. Let's see here. LaRouche founded the U.S. Labor Party in 1973 as the political arm of the NCLC. At first, the party was preaching Marxist revolution, but by 1977, they had shifted from left-wing to right-wing politics. The two-part article in New York Times in 1979 by Howard Bloom and Paul L. Montgomery alleged that LaRouche had turned the party at that point with 1,000 members and 37 offices in North America and 26 in Europe and Latin America into extreme right anti-Semitic organization, despite the presence of Jewish members. LaRouche established contacts with Willis Carter's Liberty Lobby and elements of the Ku Klux Klan in 1974. Frank Donner and Randall Rothenberg wrote that he made successful overtures to Liberty Lobby and George Wallace's American Independence Party, adding that the racist policies of LaRouche's U.S. Labor Party endeared its members to the Ku Klux Klan. George Rose, a former counterintelligence for LaRouche, who became an FBI informant in 1973, said that while LaRouche movement had extensive links to the Liberty Lobby, there was also a copious evidence of a connection to the Soviet Union. Howard Bloom wrote in the New York Times that from 1976 onwards, party members sent reports to the FBI and local police regarding members of the left-wing organization. So they were informants, supposedly. So in 1977, he wrote commercial reports on U.S. anti-apartheid groups were prepared by LaRouche members for the South African government. Bloom wrote at around this time, the LaRouche Computation Technology Corporation included Mobil Oil and Citibank among its clients, that his World Composition Services had one of the most advanced typesetting complexes in the city and had the Ford Foundation among its clients. Around the same time, according to Bloom, LaRouche was telling his membership several times a year that he was being targeted by assassination, included by the Queen of the United Kingdom, Zionist mobsters, and the Council of Foreign Relations, the Justice Department, and the Mossad.
that's an interesting collection of assassins.
In 1976, LaRouche campaigned for the first time in the presidential election as a U.S. Labor Party candidate, polling 40,043 votes, 0.05%. It was the first of eight consecutive presidential elections in which he took part between 1976 and 1974. It enabled him to attract $5.9 million in federal matching funds. Candidates seeking their party's presidential nomination qualify for matching funds if they raise $5,000 in each state, in at least 5,000 each of at least 20 states. His campaign included a paid half-hour television addresses. I think we all, I think I remember watching those when I was a teenager, which allowed him to air his views before a national audience, something that became a regular feature of his later campaigns that were protests about this and about the involvement of the NCLC in public life in general. Let's see here. In December 1980, LaRusso and his followers started what became known as the October Surprise Allegation. That's interesting. He was involved in that. Let's see here. Of course, we can. In 1984, media reports said LaRusso and his aides had met Reagan administration officials, including Norman Barley, senior director of international economic affairs for the National Security Council, and Richard Morris, special assistant to William P. Clark. There also reported contacts with the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the CIA. The LaRusso campaign said that reporting was full of errors. In 1984, two Pentagon officials spoke at LaRusso's rally in Virginia. 3 years later, LaRusso blamed his, of course, yeah, he, in 19, I believe, it would have been 1986 or 87, he was under investigation for credit card fraud. It was eventually him and several of his members' organization. He was charged with credit card fraud and, I believe, sentenced to prison in 1989, and he was paroled in 1994. He claimed it was political retribution or political... The convictions were politically motivated. So 1990s through 2004, he continued his activism. I guess, and of course, his last time he ran for president was 2004, and I think pretty much good for a summation. Of course, he passed away in 2019, just a couple of weeks ago, and that's sort of a brief overview of the strange political career of Lyndon LaRusso. That's a lot to listen to and mull over.
It surely is.
So it's convoluted, strange. Lyndon LaRusso, from a Trotskyite to right-winger, Ku Klux Klan, what to make of that? I think he's very much a man of the post-war era, a creature of the post-war era of the American empire, of these intrigues and psyops. It's hard to make sense of it. So I've talked enough about Lyndon LaRusso. What's your take on the guy and his organization?
Well, it's hard not to see him as anything other than just a total crackpot because he's so disparate, you know, like you were saying, you know, you've got Trotskyism and he was involved in, he was talking about the struggle between Platonism and Aristotelism, you know, he was all into like, is it like really a history of battle between, you know, truth and empirical, you know, stuff. He's all these stuff. So anyway, that's, you know, so that's kind of an aspect of a crackpot, you know, someone who has no real focus, but is an expert in everything, supposedly, you know, right? Well, okay, so that's kind of a negative overview, but I actually see him very positively. I think that, to me, there are three sort of... seminal individuals in terms of the alt media, and you have David Irvin, you have Eustace Mullins, and Lyndon LaRusso. And the reason I say that is because those three, long before the alt media was in existence, as we now know it, were bringing forward the idea of a completely different historical narrative than what we had, right? They had just these completely different ways of looking at history. And so, though, you know, like David Irvin was like about the Holocaust, Eustace Mullin was pretty much focused on the banking thing, the Federal Reserve. And LaRusso was sort of all over the place, unlike those two. So, but he definitely was looking at alternative historical narratives. And it isn't, it's interesting, it's not so much in his work and in his speeches, but it's in the research that comes up in what's, you know, the Executive Intelligence Review. Mm-hmm. And Bruce spawned and had, you know, as employees, he had, you know, and this is like what I really see his value is that he spawned, you know, this kind of new research into a new narrative. And And so, you have Jeffrey Steinberg, Antone Chaitkin, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing his last name right, and Webster Tarpley. And those guys really started to get into a completely different understanding of history. And I think that, with Mullins and David Irwin, they were pretty specialized, but it was under Tarpley, it was under, Tarpley's kind of banner that you started getting an understanding of Masonic influence that was outside of history. If you like go, and I hope everyone does this because they really are basically really worthwhile lectures to attend, and they're online. There's like a lecture called "The British Empire Wants You to Be Stupid" by Chaitkin. Okay, so
Isn't that like 3 hours long or something?
oh, they're just insanely
Yeah,
long.
I've listened to them from a couple
I mean,
times in my
you have to
lifetime.
be a complete maniac like me or you in order to listen to the whole thing, and particularly with Anton because he digresses. You'll get to some real gem, but you got to go through like 5 minutes of like personal anecdotes and his problems with his father and stuff. So it's hard to follow him. But man, oh man, like Tarpley's he has an interview, and unfortunately, the name I forget. I should know it, but it's about the Palmerston Zoo. I'm sure if you just Google Tarpley and Palmerston Zoo, it'll pop right up. And he goes into basically how, what he talks about is the British royal family gaining a secret control over all of the world in the parts of the 1850s. And he really focuses on Palmerston. And he actually, and what's just wonderful about all of LaRouche's scholars is that they provide really good citations. Someone who can kind of use them as a platform for research will really be satisfied because, when they describe a relationship like between Garibaldi and Palmerston, say, and I mean, that's not something that normal historians ever talk about, but man, they are right on the money. And I don't know how LaRouche was able to organize this, but to me, that's like, it's just an incredibly valuable thing is that they not only revealed that there was this hidden hand, this Masonic control that was focused to a large degree inside inside of Britain. They really focused on Britain because that's where the Masons were organized from. But it spread throughout the world. And then they also talked about how they were manipulating history, and also they were using history as propaganda. And so this began to me, kind of the alt media. This was certainly when I, just on a personal note, when I fell into the alt media after the September 11th attacks, because staring at the building collapse symmetrically, I just had this strange feeling that was controlled demolition. And when I spent a couple of months studying it, I realized it absolutely had to be, and that therefore everything was fake. The media was fake. It was really just this transition, horrible feeling, but I knew I understood what I was, to some extent, what was going on anyway. But when I then tried to understand, well, what is history, right? If like the history of 9/11 is fake, and then you look back a little bit and you start looking at World War II, and this is fake, well, what is, where is it real? And then I started realizing that it was all propaganda, right? That the whole, the American as the War of Independence, I mean, these are all Masonic projects, that there is this hidden hand in back of all of these episodes that you really have to understand, otherwise you're not going to make any real sense out of what is and how you got to where you are, how history actually unfolded, or what is history. So anyway, that's my take on LaRouche, is that when and then the other trademarks of him that I think are very important to remember is that he really went after Israel, and he really, called him on the treatment of the Palestinians. And I always think this is like a marker of someone who is not, someone who is really not just a disinfo op. even though Noam Chomsky, sometimes will get into the side. But the other one is 911. I mean, Tarpley really called him. He said, "Nah, this was, an inside job." He actually used the expression. And so, even though, he is seen as a crackpot, I was just going to put out my thought on really what his mind was. I think that, he really was an honest seeker of the truth, but if you were looking at the historical narrative he grew up with, right, the early, parts of the 20th century, it was such a controlled and artificial world that his attempts to break out of it, his attempts to get into truth, some of them were failures, I mean, like Trotskyitism is obviously absurd, but these were all legitimate efforts. And he kept changing, trying to find, a better interpretive framework of history. And so when you look at his whole life, you get all kinds of little divergence and strange kind of intellectual curiosities that you could say, well, they reflect, poorly on his psychology. He's a crackpot. But I disagree with that. I think that more likely he was just a very sincere seeker of truth who had a lot of mental energy and just had a lot of false starts to try to approach, the real, understanding of like how false the historical narrative is. And I think that's why he got into Marxism, and that's why he took up so many of the things he's known as kind of as a crackpot about. But he was always trying. The Executive Intelligence Review is really the best exposure of the Masonic control of Western civilization. I mean, that I'm aware of, even to this day. It's unique, and it's the standards of scholarship are the best that I have experienced. They are really good in their citations, and they like Tarpley and Anton, they don't exaggerate or quote mine. I mean, you get the real stuff when they start giving you the information, and so they're really worthwhile to listen to. And so hats off to Wester Tarpley and honest seeker of the truth, and made a lot of mistakes, but that's just because he was human.
What I found interesting about Lyndon LaRouche were some of his I guess subordinates who did research for him, like Jeffrey Steinberg, Anton Chekhin, and even a lot of Webster Tarpley's work, but especially regarding 9/11. Webster Tarpley also has a lecture on the nature of oligarchy, which I think is worth watching on YouTube, because it gives you a good breakdown of at least the world view of these people, and why they do what they do, what they do, and their origins and these things. So it's definitely worth listening to and even reading. The two works I find interesting that came out of the Executive Intelligence Review would be the Ugly Truth Behind the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, where he exposed how the ADL was working with the Jewish Defense League to finance to support Nazi rallies, so they could get a pretext for riots and also boost fundraising. This was a tactic I think we're pretty much familiar with now. We understand, why would Jewish organizations support Nazis? Well, I think we're a bit more sophisticated understanding. We know why, because they were kindred spirits in many ways, and even to this day. And so I was watching one of the more entertaining things to do is you watch some of Lyndon LaRouche's appearances on Crossfire, some of these talk shows in the early 80s. You have Pat Buchanan and Tom Braden, and although I have a higher opinion of Pat Buchanan, Tom Braden, who was a CIA agent, and they're grilling Lyndon LaRouche. Lyndon LaRouche is calling Henry Kissinger a child molester in these things, and Tom Braden said, "He's a friend of mine. How can you say that?" And you're watching this, and they're shooting under their firing questions at him from his various statements he had made or things he had written, and he's asking, four different questions, trying to respond to four different questions at one time, and it's these shows are always like that. The other book was also that came out of LaRouche organization was Dope Incorporated, And that was it came out late 70s, and what it really described was, up until then, people's understanding of the drug war, at least, narcotics, illegal drug trade, is that it was bottom up, that this was something that emerged in the sewer. And what Dope Incorporated exposed, actually, it emerged from the corporate boardrooms, the banking houses, and the royal houses and palaces of the world, that this was top down organized. And they gave a really good history of the drug trade, tracing it back to the Opium Wars. And this was the Opium Wars were originally waged by the British East India Company, but the British India Company was eventually taken over by the Crown, and they write about this. And this coincides with Queen Victoria being proclaimed the Empress of India in these things. And so the idea was that the establishment itself, law enforcement, the bank houses, they were organizing, cartelizing, and rationalizing the international drug trade, not just for the purposes of making a whole lot of money, but also the strategy of opium war was to use drugs themselves, narcotics, as a weapon against the population. And of course, this is instantiated and also in things like MK Ultra and the idea of sort of doping the masses and these things. And this, of course, this is written about by all the cycling in Brave New World. So it's a strategy of the oligarchs, and they're writing about this. And I came about a lot of this information through other routes, just doing your research. Then you come across the research from LaRouche's crowd, and they're pretty much saying the same thing. Slightly different interpretation, because for them everything stopped at laid at the feet of the British royal family. But they explain this as how criminal bank syndicates, Jewish bankers, how these are what they would call house Jews, and they were utilized by the royal families, and this is how they became powerful. Families like the Sassoons or the Rothschilds and these things, these banking families became very powerful in the 19th century. And so they're often pretty much with their research exposing, the crime syndicates that run the world, but often they had came to different conclusions who was at the top. But after doing a lot of the reading and this stuff, I come to the conclusion that really this is an organization. There may not be one faction at the top, maybe one faction that's more powerful at any given time. Their work was very, something like Dope Incorporated, which is a very important work. Here, good example, they talk about HSS, Jeffrey Steinberg gives an account where HSBC, the Hang Kang Shanghai Bank Corporation, was established by the British India Company to set up the financial network to handle the funds they created by the international drug trade. He gives an account in the early, late 70s, where I think HSBC was trying to buy up the Midland Marine Bank in New York. And they claim, they take credit for alerting state banking regulators to the fact that this was a criminal, HSBC was a criminal enterprise that had made all its money through the international illegal narcotics trafficking, and the merger was stopped, the purchase was stopped. But then what happened was HSBC appealed to the Federal Reserve, and they immediately gave Marine Midland a federal charter, and it was allowed to be purchased by HSBC because they needed an organization in the United States to...
they needed a drug bank to handle the
drug bank. Yeah. And if you listen to researchers like Jeffrey Steinberg, he'll lay out how basically what happened is so much money was being produced by the international drug trade, and entire banking systems and even the dollar itself depends on its circulation, because much of the same way that the petrodollar props up the dollar, the fact that for the most part drugs are sold the narco dollar, drugs are sold using U.S. currency, so they need to launder it somewhere, and pretty much they're making so much money they couldn't just run it through casinos anymore. They needed to put it in banks and invest in the U.S. economy. And so that's a great rundown on how important the international narcotics trafficking is in the global economy, and also determining the power structure of the world. And
and Dope Inc. was seminal. I mean, it's like, as far as my research of this area goes, it was really the one that alerted the public that, in fact, the banking system was a part of the drug trade.
Yeah, and years later, the was a Mr. Acosta of the UN admitted in 2009 that it was really only the proceeds, liquidity provided by the international drug trade that kept the U.S. banking system afloat during the crunch in 2008, kept credit from drying up. So the banking, that liquidity is very important. Other
Physical,
people,
yeah.
and other people have written about this, how, of course, what it is, it's also a, the system itself is designed to wreck the public, because that model is not, the final analysis is not a growth model, it's an exploitation model.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. And it's really important to understand that. That's like a something I always try to get people to at least consider, is that when you look at like the banking system, with compound interest, and you look at like the oil business, right? They're from the same group. And it's the same group that was running the slave trade. It's the East Asia Company and the addicting the coolies, right? The slave system they set up there. So when you look at the compound interest scheme, or you look at the oil business, where you have to give a little bit of money every single day, what you're really looking at is just the refinement of the slave business, right? That these guys had been in from day one. It's just amazing, and this again is Dope Inc. I mean, because they look at families, and they show that, you look at these different families, and they often connect them in the executive intelligence review more than in Dope Inc. But they tie these families to masonry. If someone, is an insomniac, and you want to go through the whole lecture series, and you start with the British Empire Wants You to Be Stupid, the one by Anton, which I really just, again, just can't recommend too highly. I thought it was just really important stuff. You can see Anton basically, go through this process. He links everything, but he links it into the British royal family. But you'll see a fascinating phenomenon, Tim, and this is something I'm just every time I've watched this lecture, I'm amazed at. Is that Chaitkin? He knows that there is something oddly Jewish about the whole historical narrative that he's revealing, right? Because, for example, he's actually the one who pointed out, this was where I got the idea from to start some of the research I did on it, that Zionism and the Nazi Party came from the same group. He actually makes this claim, right? But he doesn't go forward with that. He just says, well, it's geopolitics. In other words, that there's nothing particularly racially destructive toward the Europeans. He doesn't ever get into the concept of crypto-Jewish royal families, right? Which I think is sort of a natural one, given the fact that Victoria declared herself a Hebrew and had all of her sons circumcised, right? It just seems like that idea should be considered. But Anton can't, because I think because he knows that this would focus, too much on a Jewish organization. And Anton had actually been in a struggle with B'nai B'rith. I don't know if you know the history of this, but his father was opposed to a lot of the Zionist influence. And so he was actually, Chaitkin was like a second generation person who was struggling against Zionism. He exposes in the lecture Herzl as a crackpot, and he just says that this is British geopolitics. These are, but he, when you're dealing with a complete revolution of the historical narrative, it's probably, you're going to start with small steps, right? And I think that the LaRouche group can really be praised as far as bringing up alternative ideas about history, and exposing the narrative we have as propaganda.
And there's always some things like are frustrating because they'll go on about banking, the use of debt, and these things. Then they'll praise, you know, Lincoln and FDR.
I know. And again, this is crackpot, but I think it's honest. I just think that they, you know, to get to the august perfection of universal vision that is exemplified here on Powers and Principalities, you have to go through a process.
People rely on, like, you know, greenbackism is better than relying on a privately owned Federal Reserve Bank, right. Or FDR, he built dams and put men to work in these things. And but he also, the funniest thing is he and Webster Tarpley apologize for FDR regarding Pearl Harbor. He claims he was just fooled and
misled.
No, even if he was misled, then he should have been president.
It's just preposterous. If you dig into FDR at all, you can see it's just a, you know, Masonic cesspool.
And his family is drug. I mean, what do you think?
Of course, the Delavans. We talked about this. His first cousin ran the opium business in Hong Kong, for God's sake. Yeah. The family was just as filthy as anything imaginable. And the idea that he was fooled is preposterous. He was leading, you know, the organization that was going to bring about, the attack on Pearl Harbor, or he was one of the leaders of it. But again, I don't fault them for not having the perfection of vision that you and I have at this point.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you looked at
because there's going to be process. It's an interim position, and obviously there are problems with it, but that's just as far as they got.
We all buy into narratives, right?
And
so we take sides, and as our understanding of these things hopefully gets clearer, we have to alter our opinions of figures in history and what they all meant. I look at a lot of I have a lot of sympathies towards secession just as a principle, as a check on centralized government. As a practical matter, the right to leave a relationship is a good check on, being abused. But nevertheless, if you read the works of like LaRouche, it's like the Confederacy was just full of traitors. So was the Union. I mean, to invade the South was a traitorous act. In fact, arguably a treasonous act, whereas secession wasn't. So just based on the understanding of the Constitution, the South simply had, the Southern states simply being sovereign, had the right to leave. That isn't to say that the war itself is understood solely on those terms, because I think we both talked about how that war was sort of fomented on both sides, and there's figures on both sides, and this goes back to sort of Masonic connections and how the war is fomented. You have the strange figure of August Belmont, right, who was a Rothschild, the bastard son of the Rothschilds, who married into I think he was Commodore Perry was his father-in-law, who opened up China, or Japan, rather.
The one who opened up Japan.
And he was the one sort of fomenting, he was the one that I think created the idea of manifest destiny, and you run into all types of financial interests fomenting trouble in Bleeding Kansas, and backing John Brown and these things. So that it's an old game, and so it's difficult to sort of sort out these historical events, especially trying to get a better understanding, distinguishing or taking apart the official narrative and trying to get what really happened. Because like anything, it's like history is like that. I think it's an old Indian saying, the thing where blind men holding an elephant in a dark room, each holding a different part of the elephant. And they're both, what they're holding, they describe something different, because none of them can see a clear picture.
Yeah.
Think they're holding something else because they're holding a bit different part of the elephant. And that's a lot of when we try to unravel historical truth, that's what we run into. And as a process, there's a lot of infighting and people being accused of being shills and, whatever.
Well, the alt media. Mm-hmm. The process is accelerated here, because, everybody can get on a soapbox and spout. And of course, the historical narrative that we're being fed, American public school historical narrative, I think has pretty well been, exposed as propaganda at this point. So it's sort of like a Wild West situation where everyone's, trying to stake out their little turf and try to gain some control over the new narrative. But I wanted just to back up a second and point out that you know, when you get into the control of the narrative, and you mentioned that, you know, Belmont is this, you know, he's the Rothschild family agent in North America, and he has these mysterious ties into the financing of the Civil War, and also that, you know, he's Perry's is his son-in-law or vice versa. But we have to remember that Belmont was the owner of the New York Times, right? With Jerome, who was Winston Churchill's grandfather. So you can see that in terms of controlling the historical narrative, I mean, this goes way back, right? This is not, didn't occur for the first time after World War I or something. I mean, they've been working at this thing for the longest time. And so it has led to, in my opinion, a crisis we are experiencing now, because, you know, the maniacs in the secret society who seem to really have it in for Europeans, as best I can tell, are trying to turn us into the deltas and epsilons of the New World Order. And so I think we should resist this. And the, one of the key ways, of course, is by, you know, the spreading of the information that, you know, that our understanding of 9/11, Pearl Harbor, all these things is, in fact, incorrect. And it's propaganda just to keep us from not seeing the New World Order technology descending upon us and on our children. And so we need to resist, and we need to, like, stand up to the intimidation and bring up the, you know, honest facts and get everyone to be talking about them so we can crack the intimidation. And Tarpley, one thing you have to say about him, Tim, is he wasn't afraid to actually stand up for principle. So I think that's another thing I would give him a, you know, an accolade for, is that it takes a certain kind of character to stand up, you know, to the intimidation of the, you know, historical narrative. But LaRouche had it.
Yeah, there's a funny account, or at least a funny skit. There's a Saturday Night Live sketch.
Yeah.
I think it was in 1986. And it was basically a parody of Masterpiece Theater, with Lyndon LaRouche played by Randy Quaid, occupying, he was playing the role of Alistair Cook's chair, you know, in this show, and introducing the episode. And it featured, the show was featured the Queen of England, and she was selling heroin, you know, out of a suitcase. And she was meeting Henry Kissinger, who was played by Al Franken, the former senator, and his lover, played by Tony Danza. So basically all these things, that these accusations that Lyndon LaRouche hurled at, like, Henry Kissinger and the Queen, Henry Kissinger is a Soviet agent, or the Queen of England is the biggest drug pusher in the world. And yeah, and they're all, basically, they're all, you know, planning to enslave the Third World. And what's funny thing about that is that this, although this is a comical sketch, most people see it as absurd, it is much closer to reality than most people care to entertain, right? I mean,
I couldn't agree more. And I would think that the reason they put those elements in the skit was basically to lampoon the idea that these things were possible, because they could see with LaRouche that the historical narrative was being attacked. I mean, that's how I would. Saturday Night Live to me looks like one of these, you know, mainstream narrative reinforcers, you know, propaganda devices. And so the fact that they would have that particular comic skit with those particular elements with LaRouche is just, that's how, you know, ridicule is part of the intimidation. And that's probably what that was, you know, supposed to do.
No one, I mean, even if you bothered to read, I mean, he would say these statements like Queen of England is dealing drugs. Okay, that's a blunt statement. But what does he mean by that statement? Well, I mean, not as if you look through history, it is that the British Empire was the world's most successful narco state. That's just official history, the Opium Wars. And I don't think anyone ever suggested that Queen of England was, you know, selling nickel bags out in front of Buckingham Palace. It's much more complicated than that. It's like, you know, GE makes washers and, washing machines, but Jack Welch isn't peddling washing machines. You know, he's the CEO of General Electric. You know, so it's the same thing with the Queen of England. And, you know, if you look at the banking houses and these things, the Bank of England and the British Crown and its role in the Opium Wars and these things. So, I mean, yeah, it's easy to parody, because what happens is the mainstream understanding of the role of the Queen of England or Princess Di or the FBI, or it's based on television, the news, what they're told. Well, the public isn't told the real nature of these organizations or their functions. Or most people, I guess most people think that banks do actually, store money, and they play an essential role, and they do actually play an essential role in financial mediation and these things. And they're not criminal, and the Justice Department is there to do justice and enforce the laws that are duly passed by the people's representatives. And congressmen do represent the people. And the media is there to inform. The print and electronic media is there to inform us, so we have an informed citizenry who can go out and vote and elect responsible representatives and leaders of the country. Well, that's their view of the world. So when someone comes out with research like out of LaRouche organization, they don't know what to make of it. So they got, things that most of them aren't going to read the work. So it's going to come across as crackpot. And it doesn't help that the person saying this, is a crackpot, but it doesn't mean he's wrong about everything.
Sure, yeah.
You have to be a little crackpot, almost like you have to be a little crazy to understand these things. It's almost like I was talking to a guest this last week, and we were talking about the Leo Frank trial. And he says, the attitude is whenever you talk to a normie about this stuff, the question is, he goes, why do you know so much about this? What are you, a nut? And that's the thing. You have to be so little obsessed with these things, right?
You must be like an anti-Semitic to know so much about it.
Yeah, why do you know so much? What's your motivation about this? Couldn't it be curiosity or just know what's going on in the world so you're not, Buffalo like everyone else? But again, that's the thing, is because to get into this world, you will be considered a crackpot and a nut.
Of course. Yeah, and that's the thing is
the alternative media or alternative milieu, I think there will be a lot of nuts. It's just the nature of the thing.
It's impossible to avoid. I mean, they're going to be attracted to this area, and so LaRouche, I've actually heard arguments from people that he was like a very kind of dimensional disinfo agent, like mm-hmm. the Saturday Night Live skit, that he's actually can be seen as a more complicated version of Noam Chomsky.
Yeah.
Where really he's there just to bring ridicule to certain points that the oligarchs are afraid are going to bubble up into the historical narrative. And so you batten down these vulnerable points by putting a crackpot espousing each one of these things, so that the public then has double levels of intimidation, right, against, trying to, think clearly about this stuff. But I would just say, I can't buy it, because of the research that was then brought out by the groups that worked with him. I mean, I think that Chaitkin and Tarpley and Steinberg, I think those guys, just the hard facts that they brought out, which no one else was talking about, right?
Yeah.
I mean, who was talking about, in fact, it's just so obvious, but who was talking about like British Masonic control of Zionism in the 1960s, 70s, 80s? I mean, no one was talking about mm-hmm. this stuff. Who was bringing out the letters of Palmerston, and the connections into Herschel? So all of that was just, they were almost unique as far as bringing that out. And then the tragic and incredible period, like around 1850, where the Masons took control of all of the European political powers, right? When you had the Young Italies and, all the different Masonic aspects, and then of course the Civil War. I mean, the first time I ever heard about that process being something that was kind of a Masonic project was through Tarpley and Chaitkin. That was where that was the earliest point that I got that kind of starting point to do more research into. And so as far as LaRouche, I just feel like hats off to Lyndon. Yeah, you're a crackpot, but you had courage, and at the end of the day, what we need is like 100,000 Lyndon LaRouches. We need 100,000 crackpots who are unafraid, won't be intimidated, could care less about what people think about them. are really more interested in the truth and are willing to take some chances, you know, in terms of just intellectual structure.
There was, you know, I was watching Lena LaRouche on Crossfire, and I guess the guest host was Arnaud de Borgerov, the then editor of the Washington Times.
Yeah.
And he kept calling him Count because of his connection to the Belgian royal family. I think it was the Dutch royal family, rather.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm not a Count. He said, yeah, no, because you're an agent of the Dutch royal family. But in 2002, Arnaud de Borgerov called the Executive Intelligence Review an anti-Semitic potpourri of disinformation, factoids, rumor, gossip, Looney Tunes, and occasional fact. The Jeffrey Steinberg, the counterintelligence director of the EIR, refers to the Washington Times as the Moony Washington Times. Washington Times was founded by Sun Yung Moon, though.
Right.
Yeah. So, because then the New York Review of Books said the Executive Intelligence Review echoed Kremlin propaganda. So this is this confusing, like the Cold War really confusing. Because remember, he was always talking, he's a Trotskyite, who was, I guess you could make sense of him being anti-Soviet because of the whole Trotsky-Stalin thing.
He was always kind of socialist.
I think.
Never really completely got away from socialism. I mean, he certainly abandoned, you know, structured Marxism and the Trotsky, you know, proletariat revolution idea, but he was always intrigued with the idea of socialism. And I think that that comes, you know, obviously not from his idea of trust in government, but it just the opposite. It's that he saw the oligarchs with the control over capital were basically, you know, I think he saw them as creating a slave state. And so he thought socialism might be a way to, you know, oppose that idea.
I think he acknowledged the and this is the problem that libertarians or anarcho-capitalists would have, is they have, you know, this philosophical idea of no state and just voluntary association and trade and economic, you know, a voluntary economic exchange, yeah, which is ideal. But you have the reality of sort of a criminal oligarchy who's going to use the private sphere, and they'll organize and cartelize it and use it against you. And that's what they've largely done under the name of privatization or the free economy and these things. And that's why you have people, their idea was you need a state that represents the people to protect the people from the private interests.
Right, and it's a great idea.
The sort of like a secular church.
How do you protect the state from being controlled by the oligarchs when the state? You know,
there's an agency problem here. Yeah.
I mean, and when the public has a hard time resisting the propaganda, I mean, like this latest thing with Trump, I would love to have heard like LaRouche, you know, lampoon the whole thing. It's obviously just a, you know, an absurd distraction from large problems. But the public, you know, because it has sex, they're easily led in that, you know, to think it's a serious phenomenon, you know. And so the state, you know, with these distractions, it is able to basically control itself, you know, and so the oligarchs are never, they're never deposed, you know, we're mm-hmm. too busy with this other crap.
So he would come up with, he was a big advocate, I guess you could say, yeah, of sort of a public works, the national bank, I guess government control of the currency as opposed to a private central bank. And some, you know, all these are sort of valid criticisms of the current system. I don't know if their solutions are the ones that I, you know, support.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, one thing about LaRouche is that he did encourage a truly informed citizenry. In other words, there was diversity of new ideas in the EIR publications. You know, they had lots of different ideas. And, you know, it was interesting when I was a couple of years ago, I was in Cuba and I was talking to, you know, kind of Cuban writers. Right. So I had a chance to meet with some of these guys and we were talking and I asked them, I said, you know, like, do you think this was a real revolution or was this just, you know, kind of a Freemasonic, you know, project or, you know, like something that was controlled by oligarchs in a weird way? And this one guy, he said, no, it was a real revolution. I said, well, why? And he said, because the government really attempted to educate the people. And he said, that's really the only criteria that matters. If the government attempts to elevate the thinking skills of the public, then it's a revolution by definition. And anything else is kind of nonsense, because if the public isn't thinking better, doesn't have access to more information, then it isn't a real revolution. And so In Cuba, where of course, Marxism ran supreme up till like 1990, so a period of like what, 30 years. You would think, well, it's the state controls everything, and I'm, obviously the Communist Party is still the most powerful political force, I think, in Cuba. I think that's clear. The biggest building in downtown Havana is the Freemason Lodge, so this isn't a good indicator, But you have to remember where they came from, because in 1959, whenever the revolution was, like 1% of the population could read. This was then United Fruit and all of the slave plantations, and the women were by and large prostitutes. Bugsy Siegel and Meyer Lansky had set up just a prostitution, a paradise, basically. You can still walk down these streets and see the brothels, that they had created, just block after block. They were really going to, it was going to be like Las Vegas, except in an island. And so this is a real revolution, even if it's limited in some scope. But LaRouche, in my mind, is kind of in the same, I would look at this in the same way. I mean, it wasn't perfect, Tim, but damn it, this guy had a lot of spunk, and I would sure like people to, if obviously they won't adopt a lot of his intellectual positions at this point because they've been surpassed and perfected, and but man, I'd sure like people to adopt his courage and his zest to change things.
Yeah, and often some of the positions he strike, there any financial crisis, he'd say this is the beginning of the end. Or remember some of their hysterics regarding AIDS. In retrospect, it looks really silly. Of course, given what we've talked about, things like AIDS and the hoax behind it, the fraud behind the AIDS, it strikes me as sort of kind of opportunistically getting trying to strike fear into the public to get attention. And which I guess, I guess, what they'd want to do as an organization, and some of the stuff has to be walked back a little, I think, now, given what we know, what didn't unfold.
Yeah, for sure. But I was just going to mention, Tim, that even that I see it like a silver lining too, because one thing LaRouche was great at was getting publicity and money. I mean, one thing we don't have today, if you think about the alt media, such as it is, what is the primary characteristic that you can define it with? And I would say it is the fact that it is broke. I mean, this would be the first thing I would point out, is that it has absolutely no money. No one is really pumping, like, for example, like promoting 911, advertising, things like this, try to get people to, focus on this. I mean, the alt media is really has this unfortunate kind of, it's isolated, and it doesn't really have, there's lots of little disparate groups and things that all kind of participate in it. But LaRouche was trying, if you look at like some of the organizations he tried to create, I mean, these could be, this is sort of a template, I think, for what the alt media guys should be trying to do. Trying to set up research institutes. Look at, I mean, there was a different political world then, but LaRouche would actually have his guys go and meet with members of government.
Yeah, that's what it is. Private intelligence networks,
Right.
and I guess meet with people who might be somewhat sympathetic, or at least get information, and produce in a newsletter, there's an executive intelligence review. And this is a sign of the times now, where back then you would have to produce a very expensive newsletter and charge $400 or $500 a year for it. And now you can just post a blog somewhere and write it up.
Yeah, and this is a weakness, because it's like everyone can then reach a level of impotence and kind of incoherency, and everyone can get a couple hundred people to pay attention, but there's no growing organization. And so this would be the last kind of thing I would want to make everyone aware about LaRouche, is that look at his organizational efforts, all of which sort of failed, I mean, obviously, right, to some extent. But man, these are great ideas. Just great ideas. Try kinds of,
He named, I think it was the National Democratic Party or something,
Yeah,
and
I know.
so because of this, he got two candidates elected, or at least nominated by the Democratic Party in Illinois in 1986. And I think it was who was it? Adlai Stevenson Jr. dropped off the ticket because of it or something.
Well,
And
okay, Tim, now, and I hope you will treat this subject with the seriousness it deserves, but I actually received not one, but two emails suggesting that Kelly and Atwell consider a presidential run. So, I mean, I think the groundswell may be developing. And those that want to support us, I think that Powers and Principalities has some kind of Patreon kind of thing. But, you know, I mean, perhaps I'm being somewhat facetious, but the point is...
We'll name it the National Republican Committee as opposed to the Republican National Committee.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we'll just switch the names around.
Yeah, they get some money.
So anyway, but the idea of a presidential candidate where you can actually talk about 9-1-1 truth, you can talk about, you know, foreign media control in America, these little issues that need, you know, the banking system as a slave state. I mean, things like this, these kinds of subjects would rarely get discussed.
I mean, Jeffrey Steinberg talks about that. He's talking, exposed was the, outfits like North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the Atlantis. He described it as sort of the transatlantic Anglo-American Zionist complex, and whoever's a junior partner, senior partner is, I don't know. But, you know, what they would do if someone were to speak up against the system, they simply have them killed.
Yeah, and they point out how murderous this group is.
Yeah,
but the thing about Chaikin and Steinberg that I find refreshing is that because they're Jewish, they do not worry about the anti-Semitism. And so they can actually take on a lot of this stuff. Like LaRouche took on B'nai B'rith. Mm-hmm. And Chaikin and Steinberg were absolutely supporting him, saying, "Yeah, it's a Freemason mob run, you know, kind of." They saw it as a criminal organization.
Oh yeah, I was listening to the Crossfire. Tom Brady is grilling Lyndon LaRouche, and he starts talking about ADL being a criminal organization and mob ties, and Tom Brady is acting surprised. So what are you talking about? Mo Dallas and Meyer Lansky? I mean, come on.
Meyer Lansky would be involved in something that was illegal? Are you out of your mind? You're anti-Semite, you know? I mean, so,
yeah,
you really have to go to Havana someday and see Lansky and Bugsy Siegel's the prostitution complex that they'd set up there. I mean, it's just... I mean, to say these guys were inhuman is...
The model is you sort of economically exploit and impoverish. Then you can use the desperate people for cheap labor, for prostitution. I mean, that's the Hollywood model, right? Desperate women looking for fame and narcissistic women looking for attention will do anything for to be a star. And most of them never get that far, but they're willing to do a lot to try to get there. And that's the relationship out there. That's the whole Me Too and Harvey Weinstein thing was revealing. They weren't so much revealing, they were revealing the transactional nature of it all. Let's be honest.
I hate to digress, but I have to. So I have a friend whose daughter is trying to get into show business. Mm-hmm. And she's taking acting lessons. Very attractive young lady, And the mom said, she was told that she needs to spend 5 years, before she'll be able to become successful. It's, you have to really, struggle to get your acting skills up and work with a diction coach, volunteer plays where you. And I said, look, in 5 years, if she works hard, she will get a role as a topless zombie whose brain is taken out with an egg beater. I mean, I said, look, this is a controlled world. The people who are, given stature are, obviously are related to what the whole Hollywood structure was set up to do in the first place, right? Which is propaganda. If you're not on the inside, there's just no point in being in this trying to, I mean, they let people try to make it. And I think occasionally they'll throw someone into the mix, who's not a Masonic cesspool. But that's just the exception. I mean, it is these individuals, if you look at their background, good heavens, they're all just, it's just like, with weird scenes in the canyon where he exposed, Dave exposed the, all of the rock stars having fathers with military intelligence. I mean, you know, the show business, it's the same thing. And so just don't let your kids get in there. Rather have them, you know, set up a LaRouche inspired a political campaign, and then try to get people to, you know, see political organizing as something that's hip to do, you know, something that has energy on campuses, you know, the young people. I mean, right now we're really kind of mind numb because of the successful propaganda, and the alt media is just not really, you know, doing its job properly. You know, we're not getting to the point where we're helping people organize. I think we should maybe look back at the LaRouche guys and say, well, you know, they had a model, you know, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that was better than anything that we have out here today. So we should maybe look at how they did it. How did LaRouche get his money? You know, I mean, there has to be people out there who have money that are willing to, you know, put a nickel in, you know, to use an expression, to help get the truth out, you know. They really should be. I mean, there should be, like for our show, there should really be a major patron step up and just say, look, you guys are dull but honest, so we're going to support you. Mm-hmm. For all of the shows that kind of reach a certain threshold of coherency, you know, and audience, they should all be, there should be background people coming, but that isn't really happening. You know, I know the guys in the alt media, a lot of them, and then they're all broke. You know, they have nothing. You know, and so this is LaRouche is to me very interesting. Should be studied, don't you think, Tim?
Oh yeah, it's except you can have I guess you can have fun at his expense. That doesn't bother me. He was an odd character, and that's all fair. But you should also have the patience and maturity to look at some of the jewels that his research has produced, and it does coincide or blend with others' research about what's really going on in the world, and that's what's most interesting about it.
So many people. I mean, one way or another, LaRouche and his scholars, guys that he was organizing, are certainly at part of the basis for so much of the stuff that's gone on. You know, in terms of the alternative of history. There are, you know, a lot like I mentioned Dave McGowan. I mean, his stuff is would not be, you know, kind of directly related to LaRouche, but who knows? Maybe the, you know, kind of the mischievousness and looking at different ways of you know, kind of understanding things. Maybe that was influential. I don't know. But,
well, I mean, like Dave McGowan wrote about in Program to Kill. He talks about trafficking and these things. A good 40% of the book is about, human trafficking.
That's right. Yeah, you're things. Right. Yeah. So he was.
LaRouche did talk about how the elites were involved in some of these disgusting activities.
Yeah, absolutely. He was. They were. You know, they could see that there was really, once they started to pick it apart, and he had guys like Steinberg and Webster Tarpley, and I love Tarpley. I think he's just. I think this guy is a really good researcher. You know?
Yeah, and what he says about the Bushes is, you know, good.
You
know,
yeah, you can argue that a lot of his positions are, you know, not really evolved particularly. But man, oh man, the guy was a data vulture. He would get to the facts about things. I think he was a really good starting point. And so this is, this was the foundation, they set up the internet, and they were all set to go forward with, you know, this intellectual slave state. You know, they had, what's his name? Brand, you know, he was on the bus, you know, with Ken Kesey, Stuart Brand, and, you know, and he was obviously a DARPA agent, and he worked to develop the mouse. So you can really see how they had in mind with the idea of, like, gosh, we're going to have this personal computer. Go into the cybernetics conference at the Macy conferences, and you can really see how evil this all is. They're going to be able to use this device to program us, and they were all ready to get at us. But the fact is, there were some heroic researchers that were also basically preparing the public to be able to defend themselves. And I really, you know, I was thinking about that today. It's like, if these guys hadn't been there, you know, to kind of set the ground, then people like McGowan and Tim Kelly and the other really, brilliant guys who created this the new, understanding of history as you being used as propaganda, they would have had a much more difficult time getting going.
Oh yeah, Dave
So,
McGowan. I mean, a lot of his research was, his tips were emailed to him. So
yeah.
he'd post his blog, and people would send him the threads or trails to go under. He'd investigate it, and he'd write it up. And so that's, a good example of, you don't need a research committee or something, which what Lyndon LaRouche organized was a team of researchers. So this was just sort
Right.
of ad hoc, and it paid
Yeah.
a terrific bounty in the end. Yeah.
Well, so Tim, I think maybe anyway we can advocate that the public look at LaRouche and his organization as a template, go further with it, obviously, with better understanding of the narrative. And those who are looking for funding, that want to fund, right? They want to express their dissatisfaction with the propaganda by creating a strong organization. They should actually look at this too, because maybe they could see, well, this is the kind of organization that I want to financially create in order to have the truth have more power.
And especially when people reflect on the life and times of Lyndon LaRouche or his life, they should be more charitable in their thoughts than they will be when, say, Henry Kissinger passes or something, right? Who's considered respectable.
Yeah,
So
I
that's,
know. Just, eh, man, it's just a sad, sad world. But one step at a time, brother, we're going to get it right.
Okay, Joe, thank you.
Tim, thank you so very much. And if I may even be springier and bouncier next week because I'm going to be doing my long
Hiking?
distance walking. We'll see
Well,
if I'm not sure.
don't fall off a cliff.
That's could happen.
Or don't
If it
let
does, I didn't jump, though. Remember
it.
that.
Take it easy then.
Okay, talk to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.